I'll introduce myself. I see there's, in lieu of an introduction by someone else, I'm a kid who never grew up, who took the message of both Yeshiva University and B'nai Akiva very seriously, and I've been privileged never to work a day in my life. I'm teaching Torah. Tomorrow we're back, the Kollel reopens. It's my 56th year of teaching Torah, and Baruch Hashem, when I feel it's work, I'll know it's time to step down. But right now, thank God. Today's lecture will hit upon many topics that, as they say, unless you're a medical doctor and expect an emergency call, please turn off. But if you do have it on, at least let it play Hatikvah when it rings. We're going to touch upon, there's one theme to the lecture, but there are many topics that I could elaborate on for endless hours. Can anyone tell me what I'm holding in front of me? This is, right, this is Filel HaSeder. It becomes a bestseller here. Tells you for matzah, for korach, afikomen, for morach, how many stalks have to fit in. Tell me, I learned in the Lashon in 1870. Could anyone tell me if I ever sunnified like this in the Lashon? Is anyone here from a Hasid? I went to the first Gevur Rebbe, the Chidush Eidim, Chabgizitzim Bem, Ba'afabrengen, mit 150 Yad Zirik. Tell me, by the Gevur Rebbe, by the Chidush Eidim, did any see anything like this? No, absolutely not. So how did you know how much Masarit, how much did you know how much Marati? Because you looked at your parents, you grew up in a home, you saw what your parents did. You saw what your parents did. This is a reality. And we had a living tradition. With the upheaval of the 20th century, to begin with the emigration to the United States, to England, to South Africa, to Australia, to New Zealand, to Canada, you broke with tradition. We all know the statistics and what happened. I need not go further than Hitler, Rachmana Litzlan. It's not just 6 million Jews uprooted. It's 6 million uprooted, another 5 million lives destroyed, even the second generation and third generation. Until today, we suffer on a very personal level from what the world did to us, Hitler and the world, the accomplices, the world. I was just reading Rav Sabato's new book before I came here. I want to finish it and pass it on to other members of my family. And he describes Rav Herzog visiting after World War II. I describe it in the Suva era as well. We have the same descriptions. And Nebuch, all these children in the monasteries and how the Catholic Church hid them. And when you gave the Catholic Church a name of a kid that you know is Jewish and that they have, that kid disappeared 1 minute later. Just think for a minute what Rav Sabato says in his new book. So, yes, there was a tremendous upheaval, a tremendous destruction, no continuity. And, of course, now, thank God, we have a miracle. We have hundreds of thousands of Balei Tshuva. I would even venture a guess that the majority of Shomer Shabbos Jews in the world today, if it's not a majority, it's at least 40%. You go to South Africa, South Africa has the highest percentage of Shmirat Shabbat of any country outside the state of Israel, and it may even have a higher percentage than the state of Israel per se. And 90% of the Shomer Shabbos Jews in South Africa are Balei Tshuva. I was there for a few weeks, I lectured, I got to know the communities. So the head of the Chevra Kadisha in Johannesburg, they call it Joburg, the head of the Chevra Kadisha told me he's one of the few people that is FFB from birth, and he will not take anyone into the Chevra Kadisha who hasn't been a Shomer Shabbos for 10 years. So you see, the tradition was broken, and now we're reconstructing. My classmate, a very famous individual, I'll give him all his titles, Rabbi Dr. Professor Chaim Soloveitchik wrote a seminal article which appeared in Tradition approximately 20 years ago already, Rupture and Reconstruction. And we have this reconstruction today. It takes on many forms. At times it takes on extremism. At times it's simply no one knows how much matzah, how much murrah. Endless volumes have been published by Art Scroll where you have just a few simonim in the Shulchan Aruch, for instance, Muktza, Cholamoed, entire volumes, hundreds of pages, giving you exact details, what you can do, what you can't do, and the link is broken. This is the reconstruction. Now, at times, it takes on comical proportions. And here I'll share with you a story that broke in Yerushalayim in the late 70s. The city was shaking. Those of you who attended Yeshiva University, so you all know that Rabbi Revel was a big Makir Toiva. And his Rebbe in Raten was Reb Mendel Zaks. Reb Mendel Zaks was married to the Chafetz Chaim's daughter from the Chafetz Chaim's second marriage. So you have to understand, the Chafetz Chaim's daughter actually reached America. Reb Mendel Zaks reached America. They were saved by Yeshiva, by Rabbi Revel. The details are in the Revel book. And Reb Mendel Zaks was the bochein. Rabbi Belkin brought him into the yeshiva. He needed panasa, and he was the bochein. He was the one who gave the test and gave us our grades. Those of us sitting here all remember Reb Mendel Zaks very well. He was famous. I described him in the best book I ever wrote, Washington Avenue to Washington Street. If you recall, the cigarettes, he was always smoking cigarettes, breaking them in half, and he would smoke them. His hands were black from the burned skin. He could, and you were sitting there shaking. His fingers are on fire, and he didn't even feel it. So Reb Mendel Zaks came to Yerushalayim at the end of his life. I actually met with him here, and he died. And he left his wife, this is the daughter of the Chafetz Chaim, he left her a widow. And Friday night, it's not feminism today. The women can do almost everything men can do. And women knows how to make Kiddush. But a litvische Frau, the Chafetz Chaim's Tochter, Chavit and Hazan Stup, she didn't want to make Kiddush Friday night. So every Friday night, a yeshiva boy in Matastov, where she lived, came in to make Kiddush for her. One Friday night, now I was not there, but the story hit Yerushalayim like lightning. This yeshiva kid comes in, who knows who his parents were, his grandparents probably, I don't want to say, but they could have been monkeys jumping around with bananas on a tree, and along the way someone became frum, and the kid became frum, and he winds up in Matastov, and the Chafetz Chaim's daughter gives him a kos to make Kiddush. And he says, he looks at it, looks as if, it's nishta ashir, ain'tan sheyur, it isn't large enough. And she says to him, this is the Kiddush cup the Chafetz Chaim made Kiddush on. Okay? So this gives you an idea of our generation and what's happening. And then one of the big problems. But now I'll tell you a story that I'm not telling you a story from a third person. I write about this in the Silver Book. These ears and these eyes saw this happen. I was learning in Lakewood. All right, I don't have to tell you who Reb Aaron Cutler was. On his 50th yahrzeit, I was privileged. I gave a major talk in Yeshiva University in New York, mamish on the 50th yahrzeit of Reb Aaron Cutler. Reb Aaron Cutler, Kletzker Rosh Yeshiva, a man who did so much in America. I say I owe my job to Reb Aaron Cutler. Who heard of a kollel before? He started a kollel in Lakewood. No, it took YU a few years, but copycats. Today YU has more kollelim, I think, than I have fingers on this hand. Baruch Hashem, they gave me a place to lecture and get it out of my system in at the foot of Bayit Vagan next to Givat Mordechai. Gris Kollel, trace it back. This Kollel, that Kollel, Reb Aaron Cutler, Lakewood. So I learned in Lakewood. I'm learning in Lakewood, and again, I saw this with my own eyes. Reb Aaron Cutler, Kletzker, a yeshiva, I would shake before I would approach him, before I would speak with him. I would speak with him in third person. Who are we talking to? Rabbi Sazam Lemelt's son-in-law. Wow. So a kid, again, I don't know where the kid came from. My suspicion is, too, he was a monkey on a tree eating bananas, and he became a Baal Tshuva along the way. And this kid, I couldn't believe my eyes or my ears. He goes over to the Kletzker Rosh Yeshiva, and he rebukes Anshuldik, and he says to the Rosh Yeshiva, when you say Kedusha and you finish Kedusha, the Chasam still says, Ata Kadosh Shimcha Kadosh. Right or wrong? Are you allowed to turn around when the Chasam is saying that bracha, hakel hakodesh, after the kedusha? So it's a machlokes hapoiskim. In Litta, everyone turned around immediately. And he turned around. Reb Aaron turned around, hishtender, and he finished the kedusha, and he turned around and faced the olam. Of course, when he was saying kedusha, he was facing the Aron Kodesh. He was sitting at the Mizrach Vant. He finished the kedusha. He turned around, and the kid goes over and shows him the Kitzah Shulchan Aruch, that the Kitzah Paskins, you shouldn't turn around until the Chazan finishes Hakel HaKadosh. I tell you, I still shake until today. All right, but that's the world. That's the world. We're caught up in a world where there is a tremendous rupture. And we're involved in reconstruction. Now, let me come back to Reb Chaim Soloveitchik's article. We were classmates. When he graduated Harvard in 59, I graduated Yeshiva College in 59. And you remember, Chaim came to study with his father in New York. So we were classmates till I got smicha. I was in the same class with Chaim Soloveitchik. We were classmates. So when Chaim's article came out, there were those who were very upset. Professor Mark Steiner got hold of me. I know Mark Steiner from before. When he was a twinkle in his parents' eyes, a gleam in his parents' eyes. The Steiner brothers, one is more brilliant than the other. Professor Richard Steiner of Bernard Rebel Graduate School and Professor Mark Steiner of Hebrew University, emeritus. He's retired today. So Mark got hold of me. What is Chaim writing? He says, plenty of people remain from in America. And he wrote an article afterwards. I believe it appeared in the Torah Mada Journal, the rejoinder to Reb Chaim's article. But I have to tell you, both are correct, but Chaim is 90% correct. Mark is 10% correct. Yeah, there were those Jews that remained from in America. Few and far between. But even the Jews that remained from in America and raised children who remained from, I mean, this was miraculous, the 20s, the 30s, the 40s. But there too, there was rupture. It wasn't Europe, it wasn't Volozhin, it wasn't the Alte Gera Shtibel in Warsaw or suburb of Warsaw where Gera actually was. It was America and America with the influence of the Western world, and then after World War II, the influence of the refugees and the Yudungadisha, the Hungarians, the Hasidic sects, even those that remained from, but there too, there was rupture, and we're in the period today of Reconstruction. And here I want to recommend the volume to you that came out. Unfortunately, people don't know about it. Those of you from the Bronx, I can only recommend one volume to you. I consider it the finest book written since Shakespeare finished his writings. It's called From Washington Avenue to Washington Street. Those of you from Brooklyn, I have another book to recommend. A Sukkah is Burning by Philip Fishman. I can't go into all the details now. It happened that in my Monday class, Sunday I'm in Shasim Paiskim, but Monday I'm now doing the history of Torah in the United States. So I quoted an article from Philip Fishman. I didn't even know who he was at the time, But I quoted an article from Midstream, and he winds up telling us he davened the Slichot. He was a Torah Vadas boy, and he went the Slichot in Temple Emmanuel. And for those of you from Borough Park, correct me. So I quoted it, and I got a response, you know, from all over the world, the YUTorah.org, people listening all over the world. People are yelling, it's a conservative temple, how could he go there? So someone contacted Professor Fishman, and he contacted me, and he told me he made a mistake in the article. It wasn't Temple Emmanuel he went to, it was Temple Bethel. But the two Kusevitsky brothers, Moshe was in one, David was in the other, and he wanted to hear, and he came back to Torah Vadas the next day, and he got fined $2, $1 for being late, because the slichas took so long, and another dollar that he didn't stay in Torah Vadas, where the slichas were more spiritual than going stump to hear a chazan. But he told me he just published the book, and in his book, he corrected it. And this is the book, A Sukkah is Burning, Remembering Williamsburg Hasidic Transformation. Now, I'm quoting from the book beginning on page 37. He describes Williamsburg, 1947, the day that the UN declared partition. I want to tell the people here who went to Yeshiva Salanter in the Bronx, I remember that day, that our Rebbeim and Salanter were standing in the hallway and crying. That's what I remember from that day. And I was a kid. I didn't understand why they were crying. I couldn't understand the full impact of it. A little bit I did grasp. In Brooklyn, he describes all the shuls had Palestinian or Zionist blue and white flags hanging that day in pride that there's going to be a state of Israel. And then he says, of course, this is 47, the Satmar Hasidim now are starting to take over Williamsburg and to Americanize, and he describes the changes. But before he describes the changes, and this is just a digression, but a digression that you'll love, he describes the streets in Williamsburg. And the names Hoopa, Penn, Rutledge, Lynch, Haywood, Clymer, Ross, Lee, Wilson. Who are these people? These were people who signed the Declaration of Independence. So he describes a Torah Vadas graduate who wanted to get into Chicago Law School. At that time there were quotas. And he's being interviewed by the dean, who was an anti-Semite from the day one. And the dean asked this Torah Vadas Brooklyn yeshiva kid, give me the names of some of the great men who signed the Declaration of Independence. And the kid reels off. He recites Hooper, Penn, Rutledge, Lynch, Haywood, Clymer, Ross, Lee, Wilson. He was one of the few Jews who got in to his chosen school. And then he goes on to describe in his building, named after President Hoover. Let me just see if I have it right. He describes the building in Williamsburg that he lived in, and So Hardin, it was named after President Hardin, and he says that this was probably the only memorial to Hardin outside of the town in which he was born. And in this building, mostly Jews lived. A few were Shema Mitzvot. Those that were Shema Mitzvot, these were old-time American Jews who davened in the old-time Williamsburg shuls. He mentions the Young Israel as well, where your father was rabbi, and they built a communal sukkah, one large sukkah. Now, do you remember the shuls we grew up in the Bronx, in Brooklyn, in Manhattan of this period? Reb Moshe Feinstein has a very famous tshuva. If this was the Aron Kodesh, on this side of the Aron Kodesh there was an American flag, and on this side there was an Israeli flag or a Zionist flag. Reb Moshe has a famous tshuva, which, by the way, I was told by his grandchildren, these ears heard it. In that tshuva is the only line he ever regretted that he wrote. If you know the tshuva, you know what I'm talking about. He talks about the Zionist flag created by the vicious, bad Zionist people. He's using language that you heard here today from Nukturakata, from Satma. At that time, you heard it from the old Agudat Yisrael pre-World War II, and he wrote that in the tshuva. But he paskins, despite the fact that he's opposed to having flags in the shul, if you have it, it's okay. You don't make a ruckus over it. So he permitted it b'diavad. Not happily, but he permitted it. The tshuva is in the first volume of Or HaChaim that Reb Moshe published about 1957, if my memory is correct. In the sukkah that they built in this Harding house, the communal sukkah, there was an American flag and an Israeli flag. Fine, everything good. Few years go by, and a very successful Satma businessman moves into the building. And lo and behold, a gentleman, he describes him beautifully, well-kept and well-dressed, and a gentleman, but a man of great success. And he's elected president of the Satma Shul. And that year before Sukkot, he comes to Philip Fishman's father and to a few other Jews in the building, and he says, "Look, I'm very embarrassed. I don't object to your having the Israeli flag here, but it doesn't look nice now that I'm president of the Satma Shul. What will the people say in Satma if I eat in a sukkah where there is an Israeli flag?" And you can't believe the fight that breaks out, and people in the building are hysterical. And finally, that year, there's the big sukkah, and there's a little Hasidic sukkah, and within a few years, there are many sukkot. And where does he get the title of the book, "A Sukkah is Burning"? Because a few years later, he's coming home and he hears fire engines, Chol HaMoed Sukkos, and everyone says, in the Harding building, there's a fire. And all the little sukkahs burned down. The only one that remained standing was the communal sukkah with the American and the Israeli flag. So you see, you have to read this volume. There's much more in it. I didn't grow up in Brooklyn, but I'm approximately, we're exactly the same age. I believe Philip Fishman is one or 2 years younger than I am. So that we recall the era vividly. And at that time, there was social contact, interaction between the yeshivas. It's not like today that you wouldn't find the Torah Vadas boy anywhere near Yeshiva University, and you wouldn't find the Yeshiva University boy anywhere near Torah Vadas. In the 50s, Baruch Hashem, we knew all the gossip and all the goings on and all the Rashi Yeshiva and all the shtick, right? Believe me, in Chaim Berlin, they knew all about Rabbi Yeruchim Gerelik, and in YU, we knew all about Rabbi Yitzchak Kuttner. Probably the best that I ever wrote is my description in Washington of Rav Kuttner and Rabbi Yeruchim Gerelik interacting. It was a different world. Magnificent volume. But you see, this affects us too. You want me to show you halacha lemaisa, how it affects us? Here. We're sitting in the OU Center in Israel. When you say to an Israeli, the OU, all he thinks about is kashrut. He has no idea that there's more to the OU than just kashrut. Okay. Talk about kashrut. One of my closest friends, he's quite ill today, should have refuah shleima, a great, great individual, Rabbi Emanuel Holzer, Manny Holzer. I called him the Tsar of Kashrut. So I once asked Manny, "I don't understand you, Manny. The OU will only give a meat hepsha if it's glot. It has to be glot kosher. Hebrew National turned to the OU when Rabbi Stern died and wanted the OU to take on Hebrew National. And the OU turned them down. And Manny told me this. I can't verify it. I don't know. I'm here, there, there, and I have nothing to do with kashrut. But Manny told me there's not enough Kalat Kosher Shchita available in America, and they couldn't take on Hebrew National. And to me, that's a tragedy, because Hebrew National, is it, isn't it? The OU, you would have known. So I said to Manny, this is the exact conversation. Manny, what the heck are you talking about, Kalat Kosher? Tell me, the Rav ate Kalat Kosher in Lithuania, they heard of Kalat Kosher? The Rav once went hysterical in class against Kalat Kosher. He compared the percentage of treifot you get in the Kalat Kosher slaughterhouse and what you got in the house he supervised. Who ever heard of Kalat Kosher? Litvak is a lesson, Kalat Kosher, Mela. But, all right, and part of Poland also didn't eat Kalat Kosher. But the Hungarians came in. Manny said to me, this was his answer, I quote, Aaron, he said, dollars and cents, we have to sell our products. In America today, first of all, the Sfardim, they have to eat Kalat Kosher. It's a chumra of the Beit Yosef, a chumra of the Machaber, right or wrong. They have to eat Kalat Kosher. They have many kulot. They can eat rice on Pesach. They can do many things that we can't do. But they have one chumra that they can't avoid. They have to eat glatt kosher. The Hungarians, Satma, you're dealing with a tremendous market. The Balei Tshuva, go tell a Balei Tshuva today that in Hunger, that in Lithuania, they didn't eat glatt kosher. It's like Lakewood, I don't know if you're aware, in the memoir literature coming out now, 50 years after Baron Cutler's death, one of his top students, Rabbi Yosef Tendler, who later goes to Baltimore, he's head of the high school, runs the dormitory, a Rebbe, a fabulous individual. He died about a year and a half ago, 2 years. There's a book that just came out, Art Scroll, on his life. So he wrote a memoir of Lakewood, how when he learned in Lakewood, they used Breakstone's dairy products. Chalav, it was Stam Chalav, I'll call it. Chalav Akam, it wasn't Chalav Yisrael. And he's writing a memoir. And they say in a cheder in Baltimore, they're talking about Rabbi Yosef Tendler, and they're reading his article, his memoir, an interview with him, and this little kid, 12, 13 years old, gets up. It cannot be. This is impossible. That Rebar and Cutler would use break stones? And then, you know, you have no idea. I quoted this in class, how many stories came out across the world. And some of them, then I remembered. When they told me the story, I was there. I remembered. In Jamesburg, I think they called it, a Jamestown, you can correct me, there was a B'nai Akiva Bachad, Brit Chalutzin Vapiyim, a farm. So they used to get, then they could get Chalav Yisrael from the Mizrahi farm. And Rabbi Yankel Leshiv, the top student in Lakewood, who lives a half-hour walk from here, son-in-law of the Brisker Rav, Rabbi Yankel Leshiv, a gona dear, I will not eat Mizrahi milk. And Rabbi Aaron said to him, what's the difference if it's Shomatzir of Mizrahi? If it's kosher, it's kosher. And there was a big battle. And then finally in New York, they started with J&J and Balsam. And finally they put in the students were pressuring, not the Rosh Yeshiva. They put in an order to New York. And a big truck comes with cases and cases of Chalav Yisrael. Guess when the truck arrived in Lakewood? Shabbos afternoon, exactly. So you see, this is a world in conflict. This is a world where you have rupture and reconstruction. But let me go one step further, come to the heart of what I want to say. Tell me, should we be troubled by this? Should we be bothered by this? Rupture, reconstruction, did this ever happen before? The truth of the matter is that rupture and reconstruction is an ongoing process in Torah history. There's an entire Masechet Ediyot. What does the word Ediyot mean? Testimony. What does it mean, testimony? There was Churban Habayit. There was destruction. No one knew what went on before. There was a rupture. And all the old chachamim who still were functioning stood up and gave testimony, an entire masechet, right or wrong, testimony of what they did in the Beis HaMikdash and what they did in regarding to this halacha, you have all of Shas in Masechet Ediyot. You have witness testimony, living testimony on many questions from all six divisions of Talmudic literature. Give you another example, perhaps a more striking example. The Gemara in Gittin, Daf Samach, Samach Amud Aleph, a very powerful Gemara. I want to ask you a question. If you have a Bal Kore, Bal Kore is reading. So the Bal Kore wants to show off. All right, person wants to show off. And instead of reading from the Torah, he's looking up and he's saying everything by heart. He knows the entire Torah by heart. And by the way, many Bal Kores know the entire Torah. I plead with them to correct me. You know, there are people that are afraid to correct the Rebbe. I'm the happiest person alive when you correct me. I can't carry a tune. I have many grandsons who are good, fabulous Bal Kores. But I always say, correct me. If I mispronounce a pasuk, I misquote a pasuk, correct me, correct me. You're the Bal Kore. Tell me, are you Yotzei Kriya? But I should put on, he's looking at the ceiling and he wants everyone to see who he knows it all. Dovarim Shebiktav I Atar Rishayim Lom Ram Bal Peh. Open Gemara. And on the other hand, are you allowed to write down Torah? Are you allowed to have a Mishnah? Are you allowed to have a Gemara? Are you allowed to have a Shulchan Aruch? Absolutely not. Dovarim Shebiktav I Atar Rishayim Lekatvan. You're not allowed to write them down. But it reached a point where we can't spend 40 years with a Rebbe. We don't have photographic memories. Mori Rebbe, Rav Soloveitchik, when he came back from the Fabrengen of the Rebbe's 30th year as Nasi of Chabad, 1980, so a quote is attributed to the Rav by reliable people. The Rav said, when I prepare to speak in public, I spend hours. I rat out every word. And if you recall, the Rav would read the text. I don't speak that way. I can't. The Rav would read the text, whether it was in English or whether it was in Yiddish. He would read the text. I would say, all right, English was not his native language. But in Yiddish, he wrote it out in Hebrew, word by word, and delivered it in Yiddish, reading the text. He said, the Rebbe speaks for 4 or 5 hours, quotes endless sources, and has absolutely no text in front of him. Tell me, how many people have a mind like the Lubavitcher Rebbe? Okay? Stand up if you have that type of mind. It's like they say in Israel, there was a song, if you feel you haven't paid enough taxes or haven't done enough, you may be the women, the army, stand up. No one, an echad lo kam. We don't have memories like that. So Chazal said, Eit la sot la shem teferu toratecha. The rabbi said, we have to negate a law to save the Torah. And they permitted the writing down of Torah Shebal Peh. This is how we have Mishnayot. This is how we have a Gemara. This is how we have tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of volumes of Torah Shebal Peh written down. So you see rupture and reconstruction. I'll give you another example. This appears 4 times in Shas. I'll give you one example, a powerful example. Nothing in the world is more important than water. Baruch atah Adonai Melcholam shehakol niyeh b'dvarav. What bracha did I make? Shakal. Did I make the right bracha? The Gemara in bracha, the whole machloiket, mem dalet omid bet, mem hey omid aleph. Water is so important to your body. What is it? 89% water, 88% water. Maybe it's so important you have to make a burin of fushes before you drink. The Gemara didn't know what to paskin. Nu, what does the Gemara say? Dach mem hey omid aleph, right at the top of the page, bracha, fuch chazi mai amar. Devar. Go out and see what the Jews who care do. And they saw Minig Yisrael, Shehakol, Burin Afashir afterwards, and they paskind la halacha. That's what you do. So you see here too, the Jewish people play a role rupture and reconstruction. The Gemara in Pesachim, Daf Samach Vav Amud Aleph, we're not going into all the details, but Hillel HaZaken didn't know what the halacha was if you forgot to prepare the knife in the Beis HaMikdash when you had a slaughter, the Pesach sacrifice, Saturday afternoon. He didn't know what to do. He said, Smoch al B'nei Yisrael. Nu, can anyone help me? Lo Neviyimchem, B'nei Neviyimchem. And the Jews put it into the animal's ear, wrapped it around in the horns, and they took them to the Beis HaMikdash, and Hillel said, he saw what they did, and he remembered this is what he saw so many years ago in his youth. Rupture and reconstruction. And I'll touch up a Gemara, a Menachat. These are sources, I can go on and on, but let me just do one more, and then get back to the practical matters. Menachat Daf Chavchet Amid Bet. It's a Merit de Gemara. The Gemara says, Kol HaKein Moshe Moshe, all the Kedem that Moshe Rabbeinu made. By the way, the press is filled with it now. If you read Makor Rishon, where is the candelabra? Where is the Aron from the Beis HaMikdash? Do they have it? Don't they have it? Everything he made. So the Gemara says, Kashelo v'kashel adarot. Moshe Rabbeinu could use these implements, could use these Kli HaMikdash, and in all generations we can use these utensils. The Chatzotzrot, which we use to gather the people together, Kisherim Lo, Upsulat L'Darot. When Moshe dies, you have to bury his trumpets with him. Why? Why are the trumpets any different than the Aron HaKodesh, than the Shnei Kruvim, than the Shnei Luchot HaBrit, than the Shulchan, than the Menorah? Why were the trumpets? What are the trumpets? Kashelo, psulat ledorot, invalid for all future generations. Because the trumpets were a means of communication between the spiritual leaders and the masses. And every generation needs a different language. What was good 100 years ago, what was good before World War II, is not going to be successful today. And this is an amazing Gemara that gives us such insight. We have to go further. We have to create. We have to reconstruct. And the Jewish people play a great role in that reconstruction, the people who care, the people who live Torah, the people who breathe Torah. The state of Israel today, we're caught up in tremendous controversy. Baruch Hashem, Ben-Gurion's dream came true and didn't come true. On one hand, he deserves all the credit in the world. When people ask me, Charedim ask me, why do I celebrate Yom HaTzmut? I punch them in the nose and I say, because Ben-Gurion had the guts to stand up to the USA State Department. You just think what's going on this past week with Bennett calling Cohn Kerry to order. Kerry only happens to be a direct descendant of Reb Yehuda, the brother of the Maral. And what the state, what's going on, if you listen to the talk shows, the radio, America has no other problem in the world than Bennett called Kerry an idiot to the second power in dignified language. We know he is, but that he should have the chutzpah. So on one hand, Heyiyah, people say, what happened Heyiyah? Why not Vaviyah? Why not Zeviniyah? Zayiniyah? What happened Sukkos? Why Dafka Sukkos? Yitzhiyat Mitzrayim, I can understand, was Tetvav Nisan. But Anane HaKavad, we could have made Sukkos any time. You understand? So Heyiyah. But I always got a sharp answer. Because Ben-Gurion had the guts, Erev Shabbos Kodesh, in Tel Aviv, to declare the state of Israel. On the other hand, he had another vision. There wouldn't be a religious Jew left in the state of Israel. And if he didn't have the vision, his wife's enmity towards religion. This was the rebellion. You just see it. Someone was interviewed recently. They have a, you can see it on YouTube. It's just beyond words. He's a Lebreslava, he's a Talmud Chacham, and his mother won't even put up mezuzahs, and she's smoking, and narishkeit, stupidity, shtuyot, ainli chaylik b'zeh, and Baruch Hashem, you should see the kid, and he gets along, his father just died, it's a famous author, and he gets along with his mother, and kala kavot to him. So Ben-Gurion had a vision that, oh, give it 20 years, there won't be a religious Jew left. We're creating a new Jew. And take a look in the state of Israel. We have at least 2 million Jews that are Shomer Shabbos. And it grows every day more and more. You have the birth rate, you have the Balei Tshuva. All right, we have problems too of those leaving. The challenges are great. Believe me, there's a lot to be said on these topics, but it's not for now. The challenges are great. But in Israel today, you see, there's rupture and reconstruction. The Haredi world, and for someone who knows the Haredi world up close, it's a beautiful world. It has feeling and emotion and lebedikait, and reverence, and I don't have to tell you what the Haredi world is about. On the other hand, this is a Milchemet Mitzvah. Just think for one second what would have happened to us if we would have lost the war of this past summer. Abbas stated it openly. He accused us of committing genocide in Gaza. What he really was saying was, too bad I couldn't do genocide in what is called Israel. That's what he was really saying. By the way, I refer you to Kol Dedida Fake of the Rav with John Forster Dulles. You'll see the same vart. And it's Milchemet Mitzvah, Mishnah in Sota, Nu the Sugya Daf Mem Daled Daf Mem Hei, Psak of the Rambam, Hilchot Melachim, Perek Zayin. Even a Chatan V'Kala have to go out to fight. Okay, and this is halacha. What are we, reformed Jews? What do I rip it out? What am I, a reformed Jew? I can drive on Shabbos. What am I, a conservative Jew? I can eat fish in a treif restaurant. All right, today the conservatives are way beyond that. But we're from Jews. You're a Haredi Jew. I have a picture I showed around to many Satmar. And I have to tell you, within Satmar, there's a whole element that is very enlightened and knows the score. All right, they have a commitment. It's an emotional commitment, but we have hopes for their children. As you see, the great-grandson of the Sigita Satma Rav is now becoming a tzanchan in the IDF. So, and he's a frum boy. He's a frum boy. So I showed a picture that, fortunately or unfortunately, in my own family, I was Mekayim the Gemara, the Mishnah, the Psak of the Rambam. My grandson, who married July 2nd, he and his wife were both called back to the army at the last day of their Sheva Brachas. Mamish, a Chatan V'Kala. And in the picture, from the last day, they were already called up. So my grandson wasn't in uniform. He's in regular army. He'll get his uniform when he joins his unit. He was given 26 days off to marry, but the war canceled it. My daughter-in-law, my granddaughter-in-law, is in Miluim. She's a katsina. She's an officer in Modi'in. So you see this picture, my grandson and my granddaughter-in-law, uniform, officer, her hair covered down to here. And you understand, this is rupture and reconstruction. It's difficult. For years, whoever heard of an army? Did the Gera Rebbe go to fight? Did the Reb Chaim Briska go to fight? You all know the famous story of the Maggid, who in Europe, they didn't have rabbis speaking. No one wanted to hear a rabbi. Rabbis, were their job was the Paskin Shilas. But they wanted to hear a Maggid, so there were professional Maggidim who went from city to city. So there was a famous Maggid who went through Europe in the early 1900s, and he gets up, this happens in Grodno, where Reb Shimon Shkop was Rosh Yeshiva, the great Reb Shimon Shkop, and he gets up and he gives a whole drush and he starts mocking the Zionistim, the Zionists. Well, you understand this is the old time enmity to the Zionists, which I can understand. They were building a new world, the world of Ben Gurion, a world without Shabbos, without Kashrut, without Taharat Mishpacha. And he gets up and says, the Zionistim, I'll say it in English, but I'm living it in Yiddish, the Zionistim are going to build an army, going to fight to take back the land. No, we'll call every Jewish male between 18 to 30, stand on this open space, we're forming an army, come to this park, we're going to form an army. 100,000 Jewish boys show up. Nu, mi machta Yiddish soldat, then you need a Kohen Mashuach Muhammad. You need a Kohen. The Kohen has to get up and he has to say, who is the man who just got married, is engaged, planning to marry? Go home. 25,000 guys disappear. Who is the person who just planted a vineyard, who just bought a house? Go home. You're left with 25,000 people, but then comes the killer. Mi hayish hayarei v'racha levav. And Chazal tell us, what does it mean, yarei v'racha? It's an open Yerushalmi, also in the Bavli a little bit, the Rambam Paskins la'alacha. What does it mean? If you speak between the Tfilin Shel Yad to the Tfilin Shel Rosh, you speak. You. Someone asked you, what did the Yankees do last night? And you answer instinctively, you're out of the army. So, if you speak between Yishtabach to Hameir, from Yishtabach to what Kamer Yodse'ah, to the next bracha, if you speak, no, and the market is laughing, Vetkeb Libin, who's left on the battlefield? The Gerer Rebbe, the Belzer Rebbe, Rebbe Yitzchok Chan Inspector, and the Netziver Velozhin. And he says, Mitzei Vel Memachen Amulchama, with them we're going to go to fight. And Reb Shimon Shkup was hysterical with laughter. It is told when he came to Brisk and told the story, Reb Chaim Soloveitchik couldn't understand. What's Lachna? Why is everyone laughing? Of course we'll fight with them and win the war. You understand? Tell me, how does Rakefet know this? Okay, I read it. Why am I so sure this actually happened? Let me let you in a little story. 1977, I finished basic training. I was here in Israel already 8 years, 9 years, whatever. The government sent me back to speak at the Rabbinical Council of America convention. After the convention, they arranged, I went to a number of cities and spoke. One of the cities I spoke in was in Detroit, a suburb of Detroit, a big young Israel, I think it was Southfield, Michigan. And I tell this story with the drasha of the Maggid. And after I finish speaking, they wheel up a man in a wheelchair, 102 years old. And the man asks me to bend down to him, and he hugs me and he kisses me, and he says, "Wie kann das sein, ein amerikanischer junger Mann wie du bist? Ich hab gewählt bei dabei. I was there in Grodno. It's exactly the way you told the story." And Reb Shimon the Rosh Yeshiva was hysterical with laughter. Exactly the way you told the story. So you see, and this goes on, it's not only the tzava, you take the toknit haliba, it's a new word in Hebrew, core curriculum, toknit haliba. Ribbono shel Olam, look at the Rambam, Perek Gimel, Hilchot Talmud Torah, what it means if you don't give your child an education. The Gemara says you're raising a gangster. We know, someone just went to jail, it'll wind up for life. He only embezzled from people, from other Jews. This is a graduate of one of the most famous yeshiva, perhaps, in the non-YU world in America. He only embezzled hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars. Madoff Jr., except he davens 3 times a day. Yeah, you raise gangsters if you don't teach English, computers, mathematics. What's going on today? The kippah srugah. Could you imagine a man who is supposedly a rabbi, a rebbe, a rosh yeshiva, gets up in public and says, if you wear a kippah srugah, you are a malek. And he refused to back down. He was asked again and again, You are a Malek. I don't want to, you all know who I'm talking about. This news, this is here, this is Yerushalayim, this is around the corner from here. So you see, we're caught up in tremendous conflict, but it's healthy. It's natural. It's rupture. It's reconstruction. It's a new era. It's a new people. It's a gathering of the exiles. It's a new country. Miracles are happening before our eyes. We're all part of it. We all play a role in it. We are shaping the destiny of the Torah people. It won't happen overnight. We're not going to create an ideal society overnight. But we're caught up in this conflict. And im lo nevi'im heim, b'nei nevi'im heim. Fuk chazi, go out and see, my amad davar. We are creating the trumpets for our generation. And let me go a drop further and come to the purpose of this evening. First of all, I have to apologize. I feel very bad. I feel terrible. I don't have a solution. Publishing books today, of niche books, in other words, if I would write a bestseller about what goes on in Washington, D.C., in our world, any publisher would grab it and publish it because a book of schmutz would sell a few million copies. But I don't write bestsellers. My seven books, six are pure scholarship, the seventh is a scholarly memoir. When I first published my first book, which changes my whole life, it's not for now to go into it, but brings me to Israel, JPS, Bernard Revel, my doctorate, the publisher was interested in seeing that the book was disseminated. They published for a reason. JPS was a big publishing house. Jewish Publication Society, the United States, the most prestigious publishing house. At that time, I'm talking the late 60s, mid 60s. They sold the book, they pushed the book, they advertised the book. Today, the publishers outside of Art Scroll couldn't care less. Art Scroll has a mission, it's endowed, it raises money. Publishers couldn't care less. They get their money up front, they get the dedications, and my good name was used to get dedications. They got dedications. Fourth edition of Revel, fourth edition of Silver, Panim Chadashot, there's a little new material, new introductions. No one's interested in selling it. The books were published in America, go fly a kite. I pleaded with the OU here, contact them in America. They contact them in America. America, how do we get them across the ocean? So I just apologize. There are no copies of the Silver Book here. And the Silver Book happens to be a good investment. Very simply, why? If you're familiar with eBay, my Talmidim showed me that a mint copy of the first edition that I got a Fashlunken a quarter for royalties just sold for $1,800 on eBay. Rembrandt died bankrupt, then go buy a Rembrandt today. Rakefit protests officially. So it's a good investment, Silver. Forget about what the knowledge the book has, etc. The only way to get the books are to go to the websites, the OU, what else? What are the other websites? Amazon, whoever's selling books. It's the only way. No one's interested. They would give the author, yeah, Rakefet here, we'll give you, here, take 1,000 books, we'll give it to you at the, you know, author's price. Take them to Israel, stand in Ben Yehuda, and sell your books. Baruch Hashem, I've lived in Israel 45 and a half years. I'm not yet reached the point where I have to stand in Ben Yehuda and play my fiddle. Okay, God have mercy. We do have some copies of Revel here, and if anyone wants it, you can get them afterwards from the OU. I think there are 22 copies. Those copies have nothing to do with the OU. They were given to the OU today by Yeshiva University. We had copies in Gris, and they were shifted here. Let me end off and let me say a few words, and I apologize to the memories of Bernard Revel and to Eliezer Silva. These men were giants. What characterizes them is rupture and reconstruction. Bernard Revel running away from Europe, an Eloi, photographic memory, what we spoke about before, got involved with the Bundists, winds up in a czarist jail, 1905, gets out of jail and runs to America to join his half-siblings, half-brothers, we hear already, perhaps a half-sister, in America, I should say, comes to America, a greenhorn, goes to the Lower East Side, the Yeshivas Rabbi Yitzchak Hanan, Rabbi Leventhal of Philadelphia, comes in every week to see what's going on in the yeshiva. He sees this young man with red hair, has given a reita, and he sees what he knows, brings him to Philadelphia, makes him his assistant, tells him he has to go to college, it's America. Bernard Revel winds up getting the first PhD that Dropsy College gives today. It's part of U of P. He writes on Karaitic literature, Chachmat Yisrael, scientific Jewish scholarship. The first shidduch made in America, Rav Moshe Big told me this, the erste shidduch was bim gemacht in America, was Bernard Revel. Rabbi Zivitz of Pittsburgh knew Rabbi Revel because he would come to Rabbi Leventhal's house in Philadelphia. He would also go to Marietta, Ohio, once every few months to Paskin Shilas for them. And there was a frum girl there, Chaya Sarah Travis. And he made the shidduch between Revel and Sarah. It was a fabulous shidduch. And he was independently wealthy at that time. He worked in the oil industry with his family. And they plead with him, come to New York, 1915. We want to organize a high school. The American kids, the yeshiva kids, are running away from the yeshiva. They demand the high school. It's America. And Rabbi Revel agrees, condition he takes no salary. And January 1916, Talmudical Academy opens. That's not enough. He opens Yeshiva College 1928. He opens the first graduate school of the yeshiva, which today is named in his memory, Bernard Revel Graduate School, where your father was the first dean, thanks to your husband's correcting my calling a Rabbi Landed dean. But it's a correction and not a correction, because the world will not understand the title director with the recorder, Mrs. Carden, running the school in reality. So that was organized by Bernard Revel. So you see here Reconstruction America. But there was more than that. Rabbi Revel deserves the greatest vote of thanks because what bothered him about America, he still recalled Europe. And he wasn't willing to make peace with the low level of learning in America. And he shopped around in Europe. Who could he bring to America? Which great Rosh Yeshiva is willing to come to the Treifa Medina, as it was called, and to teach Torah in what is today YU? And Rav Shlomo Palachek, the Meitzer Te'iloi, the great Talmud of Rav Chaim Briska, but he had one tremendous fault, Nishvakenim Gedacht, the Meitzer Te'iloi had become a Mizrachiite. And because he became a Mizrachiite, he couldn't stay in Europe. I'm quoting him. I'm quoting the Meitzer to now. He couldn't stay in Europe. So he agreed to come to America. He came to America September 1st, 1922. It changed the whole atmosphere of yeshiva. You now had a Rosh Yeshiva who was the equal of anyone in Europe. But we Jews have no mazel. The Gemara in Shabbos, Ein Mazal LeYisrael. He died in 1928 of what today is cured with one shot of penicillin. It's before antibiotics, osteomyelitis of the gum. Rabbi Revel was totally upset. Where do we go from here? Reb Shimon Shkup, who we spoke about before, was then in America raising funds for Grodno. So he pleaded with him to stay, and he stayed for 1 year, but then he was ordered back to Europe by the Chafetz Chaim to his yeshiva. But Reb Shimon told Rabbi Revel, Reb Moshe Soloveitchik would also come because his wife had converted Reb Moshe Soloveitchik, who had been the son of Reb Chaim Briska, who is not only opposed to Mizrahi, but opposed to Agudas Yisrael, considered them apikarsim. Chadash Hashlom in HaTorah, anything new is forbidden. And over the years, Rebetzin Pesha turned Reb Moshe into a shtickel at Tzioni, a Mizrachist. He taught in Tachkamoni, Mizrahi, Warsaw. He came to America. And as they say, the rest is history. Reb Moshe came a few years later, his son, Mori Rebbe, Reb Yosef Dov HaLevi Soloveitchik came, and the students that they raised, Rabbi Soloveitchik, the students that he raised, I don't want to go into a long list of names, but the Talmidim can hold their own with any American product, from Lakewood to Teta Vadas to Chaim Berlin, you name it. They produced wonderful graduates too. Not all, some. Why you? Some. But that some we can be proud of. So you see, this was Rabbi Revel. Rupture and reconstruction. A few words about Reb Lazer Silver. Why do we need someone like Reb Lazer today? I personally am shaking from what has happened in the rabbinate the last few years. Don't want to use the word scandals. Here, America, it's frightening. Belgium, what's involved? I don't want to go any further. What will be yet in Israel if a former chief rabbi stands trial, if anyone has any contact with Rabbi Metzger, plead with him to accept a plea bargain and go to jail for whatever the government will insist. But chas v'chalila, not to go to open court. I know some of the facts involved in that case. It's overwhelming. It's frightening. I have to face students tomorrow morning who I want to encourage to be rabbis. How do I look them in the eye with what's happened in the Torah world this last week? I'm shaking. I have divrei Torah to say tomorrow. I hope it'll help a little. But do we need a Reb Lazer Silver? Born in Europe, came to America. You know why he came to America? Well, let me tell you the truth. Because he walked into the Strashun Library in Vilna, early 1900s. Anyone know what the Strashun Library was? The largest rabbinic library in all of Europe. And one of the librarians was a pretty girl, and he struck up a conversation with her, and he married her. And the world was going crazy. He was the son of the Dushtat, the Rav, Reb Senech Bunim Silva, and Anna Shidduch, and he makes his own Shidduch, and he falls in love with a girl, and no one set him up. So he said, the heck with you all. He left the gossip behind, got on a boat, came to America in 1907. And he wanted to, make a living, so he sold insurance. He had family in America. And he, of course, he went bankrupt within a few months. All the money they gave him was lost. They pleaded with him, forget about insurance, become a Rav. And he went to Harrisburg, 1907. Later he goes to Springfield, 1925, and 1931 to Cincinnati, where he remains the dominant figure until today, revered Reb Lazer Silver in Cincinnati. But here too was a man, on one hand, a Yudapeyish Rav. Money was meaningless to him. The congregation ultimately stopped paying him a salary. They used to give it to his wife because he could walk from the shul going home, and a poor man approached him with a heart story, with a heartbreaking story. He has to marry off a daughter. You know the story, what goes on. Everyone from Israel, certain people, it's a whole business all over the world today, where you travel, and you have a driver, takes you around, he gets a percentage, and someone gives you a list, and he gets a percentage, and he could give the money away, there'd be nothing for when he got home, he had nothing for the Rebbetzin. So they would pay her. When he died, there's a story circulating, it's not true, but the fact that the story is circulating tells you who he was. They said they had to raise funds and tells to pay for his funeral. That's the story that circulates. It's not true. But the fact that they tell that story, it's like the Lubavitcher Rebbe. His whole estate, I think, equaled $58,000, including the house he was living in. It's beyond words who these people were. That commitment, that total honest commitment, the Torah personality. He was a big man in the Agudat HaRabbanim, and he tried to merge them with the young American rabbis. He never succeeded. There was opposition. He had vision. He organized Agudat Yisrael in America in 1937 because his Rebbe, Reb Chaim Moshe, told him he had to organize it. But above all, he organized the Vad Hatzalah. And this man, indefatigable. He got Reb Aaron Cutler to America. The people he saved, the money he raised, he turned over heaven and earth. Total commitment and genius. 46, he visited the DP camps. Got Senator Taft, his good friend, to get an act of Congress that he's allowed to wear a military uniform. He's officially part of the American military. He took Prussia to save his life, going to Poland, the riots that were going on, the pogroms. And he had $100,000 inside his coat, which wherever he went, he gave out to people who needed it. But he made one condition, and you just think about this, that you lost, and I know people, I know families, I've taught children, you lost your wife and children. Who wants to remarry? Who wants to start all over again? You're broken. Do you have any idea of the trauma that those who were injured in the past summer, the trauma they are going through, those who were injured and are recovering? The trauma. Could you imagine the trauma? I just spoke with America, a kid that I encouraged to go into the paratroopers. Unbelievable. Reb Lazer, a husband lost his wife, a wife lost her husband. Who wants to start over? He gave the money, made one condition. If you don't remarry and start all over again, you've given the Nazis another victory. And this man had such insight. So many people got encouragement and understood. And there's an unbelievable story. It's been immortalized in Simon Wiesenthal's book. I immortalize it in the Silver Era. An unbelievable story where in one of the DP camps they were setting up a shul and they were dedicating a Torah that Sunday. In that DP camp, Simon Wiesenthal was the main figure, the leading figure. And Wiesenthal announces he's not coming to the dedication. He has no use for religion. So Reb Lazer went over to him and said, Shimon, what's your problem? I'm not telling you to be religious, but at least come, a public event, dedication of a Torah. And Wiesenthal says to him, I was in this camp, and there was a Jew who had smuggled in a sitter. And every night people stood on line to use the sitter and say a few words of davening. I couldn't get over that Jew. What a wonderful Jew. And then I found out he was charging each one for the use of the sitter a piece of his daily bread allowance. I want nothing to do with religion. And Reb Lazer said to him, Shimon, I didn't know you were so foolish and stupid. Why do you look at the selfish individual who insisted upon taking a piece of bread? Why not look at the Jews who were willing to give away a bit of their sustenance for the sake of holding a sitter in their hands? And Reb Shimon said to Reb Lazer, Shimon said to him, you've taught me something I will never forget. And he came to the dedication the next day. What individuals. I want to end off with a little story and one more word of Torah. But first, let me reiterate, as I said, I've touched upon topics tonight, each topic. Some of you know I have lectured on for thousands of hours, literally, not just figuratively. There's no question that this chart represents the tragedy of our times, the tremendous rupture, but it also represents the miracle of rebirth, the Baal Tshuva movement. When we were growing up, no one ever heard of a Baal Tshuva movement. I often tell my students, my own grandchildren, that when we made a commitment to be frum, you put a kippah on. That was an unbelievable commitment. You didn't need a beard, you didn't need payas, you didn't need black clothes, you didn't need a uniform to be frum growing up in the Bronx. What are you talking about? What kind of Shabbos was there in the Bronx? Today, Baruch Hashem, tens, thousands, hundreds of thousands, go to Uman, Rosh Hashanah, see what's going on. I have a grandson who went this year, came back inspired. I'm an Alta Litvak, but if it inspires, it inspires. I spoke with him at length. I see why. Kol HaKavod. So we're caught up in this rupture and reconstruction. But it's nothing new. I showed you so many Maimari Chazal, and I could show you many more. And don't forget, Moshe Rabbeinu could build the Aron HaKodesh forever. We're looking for it now. But the Chatzotzer have to be buried with him. Every generation needs its own. And in Israel, with the ingathering of the exiles, with the tremendous burst in the Haredi population, that Haaretz is shaking, that in 20 years there will be a majority. Well, if you're a majority, you got to take over the army, you got to take over education, you got to take over finance, you got to take over technology, you got to run the country. And believe me, they're going to get there. And two tremendous figures that I'm privileged, my books have become classics in their fields. If you know how many times Revel and Silver have been quoted, Silver was actually called in a scholarly journal the single most excellent volume on the history of Orthodoxy in the United States. And I quote it word by word from a scholarly journal. So Baruch Hashem, these are two towering individuals whose memory we should honor, whose memory we should hold in such esteem. Regarding Bernard Revel, I told the story before, I tell it again for those who didn't hear it. It's an amazing story. My whole life changed the day that Rabbi Dr. Bernard Lander, Bernie Lander, assigned this topic to me for my doctorate. On the committee were three wonderful individuals. Dr. Hyman Greenstein, professor of American Jewish history, was the chairman of the committee, and your father, Dr. Sidney B. Honig, and Dr. Abraham Duca were the other two members of the committee. And I did my research. I became very close to the members of the Revel family that survived. Now there's no one left alive. His children didn't marry. There are no direct descendants. Became very close. And then JPS took the volume, and that put me on the map. And when I applied to the Jewish Agency in 68, I want to go in Aliyah, they said, what do you do? I said, I'm a rabbi and I have a doctorate in Jewish history. They said, oh, rabbis and doctorates in Jewish history sweep floors in Jerusalem or work in the zoo. And they did that purposely to discourage you. They wanted to know, of course, they had a terrible problem in 67. Every type of drug addict came from America. You got to find out the history here. So by 68, they were under instructions, check that these people are legit. So when I gave them my CV, on this side of the ocean, the Encyclopedia Judaica was looking for editors, people who could write, people who knew something. They came to America to interview me. They brought me to Israel. They brought us to Israel. But I have to tell you, today, I could, if this would be today, knowing what I know, I could have never been assigned a doctorate on Bernard Revel. Does anyone know why? Because walking through the streets of Gula a few years ago, I picked up a book called Yasayus Runi about the Kovna community. I opened the book. I contacted the author. I fainted. My wife revived me. Bernard Revel was my cousin. We share the same, his grandparents are my great-great-grandparents. We share the same family, Kalvariski. And I never paid attention to my mother, Zichrona Levracha. She used to tell me, "Ha mama kumt mazamish pachon as a frum," and she would give me details. And I never paid attention because those grandparents had two sets of grandparents. That grandfather, whose Jotzai was just the Shabbos, I said, Kaddish, learned in Velazhin. Could quote Gemaras by heart. In America, he went to shul, Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. Maybe Simchas Torah. So my mother's time, my other grandparents who knew, my grandfather knew absolutely, my Zaydin knew absolutely nothing. He only knew how to daven. You, Avram, you remember my grandfather, knew how to hold the siddik, the ven ashlich, he didn't know what the words meant. Was never ever Mechalel Shabbos. All the 60, 70 years he lived in America, 70 years, he never was Mechalel Shabbos. That grandmother was a tzaddikin, I'm told, but she died when I was very young. So I never paid attention to my mother. And then, without going into more details, what I found out in that book with Revel Kavarisky, and it all ties in with a little cyclamen named Rakefet. And I finally want to conclude. The truth of the matter is that everything I said tonight can be summarized with one thought. We just finished a magnificent holiday. Everyone is happy. The holiday is over. I said to a nice Jew, a Hasidic Jew, I said, a good, nice Yontif. And he says to me, oh, you're also happy the holiday is over. I looked at him. I'm the saddest person in the world. I put up a sukkah, Dalid Minim, for my money. I would like Pesach 6 months a year and sukkah another 6 months. For my money? Wow, absolutely. Matzah, I love. The greatest treat you can give me is matzah. I just had whole wheat matzah today. Kam Gan Eden. So you see, you talk about sukkahs, so Chazal say, the rabbinic literature says, Notel lulav ve'etrog betocha sukkah. You take the lulav and etrog in the sukkah every morning. When I wake up, I would go into the sukkah, make the bracha, and then I went to shul. No, what does this mean, Notel lulav and etrog betocha sukkah? You see, this is the greatest challenge to a Jew. What does lulav and etrog represent? It represents temporal life, agriculture, economics, call it what you wish, physical, gashmiyut. And what does the sukkah represent? Anane hakovat, spirituality, the Ribbono shel Olam watching over us, the spirit of Torah tradition, all that has kept us until today. A Jew has to know how to balance out the two. Notel lulavi etrog betocha sukkah. When you know how to balance out the two, then you will succeed with rupture and reconstruction in a magnificent fashion. L'kavod u'letiferet. I want to thank everyone from the bottom of my heart. I see so many wonderful faces here, so many people that I've interacted with for the last 70 plus years. So I thank you so much for coming out on this rainy night. When it started to rain, I said, oy vey, I make a commitment to speak at night, which I really do. I'm an older person. I teach in Gris. Anyone wants to hear me, you're welcome to come to Gris. But I thank you from the bottom of my heart. And it should taka be a guten eis yontif, and a gesunter, and a gesunter, and a gebenched winter, as they say here. Thank you so much. Brucham to you, Brucham to you.
Very nice.
Brucham to you. So tell Grace, she said to me this morning, a book launch, the Rebel, the silver book is not here. I'm embarrassed. The Rebel book they got today from YU.
Do you think the other one will come here?
No, it'll never come. You have to get it through a website.
Oh, really? That's the only way to get it?
Yeah. They don't want to send it over the ocean. It's too.
Amazon will have it?
Yeah, yeah. No, well, the OU, but Amazon should have it. It's.
Thank you.
Shikaya.
I had the privilege of living in Cincinnati for 9 years. Uh-huh. And many Shabbosim I davened in the Silver School. He was already nifter. I never met him. But his wife was still alive.
The second wife. That's the second
wife at that time. And
that's not the wife from Vilna.
No. But
I understand.
But I knew many people who knew him.
Right.
Some of the older people in the shul. There was a man in the shul named Al Harris. And I was in my 20s, he was in his 80s.
Right.
So he told us the story that his father told him. His father, maybe you know this, maybe not, but I'm sure if you don't know it, then
go ahead.
It was the Bar HaTzala, they went to, after one of the pogroms, they went to President Taft to visit in the White House.
Yeah, that's not
the book.
I think it's 130 after Eshka.
Who?
The girl in back, she's in charge.
They went to visit President Taft, and he says at that time they were all wore these cylinders.
Right.
So they come to the White House, and they're waiting to go to the Oval Office, and they ask Rebbe, do we take off our hat to the President of the United States? He says, do what I do. Okay. So they come in, the President is sitting at his desk, and they have a row of chairs around the desk. They all sit down. President Taft, who was like 300 pounds.
Right.
He sees them, he greets them, he looks at them, he gets up out of his chair, he walks to the closet.
Takes his hat. Right.
And puts it on. Heard that story?
Yeah. So, beautiful.
So his father was one of the people at that. He told me the this story years ago. I tell it a lot of times. So.
But I,
anyway, it was a pleasure. Thank you.
I couldn't move sideways. It was too late. I wanted to go in to the problem of chinuch here and what we contributed, but it's another hour.
Last night, I was Rabbi Wein, who spoke about American Teen Wars, and he mentioned one of the positive aspects of Bnei Akiva. And we can all, I said, we all can admit that Bnei Akiva really
saved us.
Absolutely. Even though it came from Frum homes, but it was, right, we were not committed.
Absolutely.
Bnei Akiva made us committed to Yiddishkeit.
Got a pen, you want to sign this?
Wow.
Thank you
very much. He's become a shtickle about tshuva. I'm not joking. The right-wing world has excommunicated him.
Who?
Rabbi Wein. They're not happy with him.
Oh, they're not?
No, he wrote articles that someone said Rakefet could have written this article. This summer. We're talking summer.
Does he have a label on him, or is he tries to stay away?
He's now labeled a revised religious Zionist.
Yeah.
You follow? Absolutely. One second, I'll write it in Hebrew. What's your wife's Hebrew name?
Yehudit. Chaim.
You want? You got any middle name?
Chaim Menachem Mendelbert, but just put on Chaim. Beautiful speech. Did you take you a long time to prepare?
Baruch Hashem. I'm busy.
You're a good man. I know him for almost 60 years, so I can talk to him.
I know him as Herbie Maltz, but he gets mad at me when I say Herbie, not Chaim. But Chaim Menachem Mendel, Baruch Hashem, Rabbi Tov, Nor Rav Alia.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
See you next week.
Is it possible to get a recording of what was said here?
Ask the fellow in the white shirt there, my Talmud. His name is Yomo, Yosef Mordechai.
Okay. Also, I came late because I was in Ulpan earlier this evening, so I missed the beginning, but at the end you mentioned something with that chart, with the matzah.
Yeah.
Well, what did you say about that?
You have to hear it in context. Oh. It's going to go on the YU Torah website.
Okay.
So no matter what, but ask him.
Right to Yaron Leibovitz, my son, to give him. He's a YU graduate.
Yaron
Leibovitz.
Yaron?
Leibovitz.
I came and I started putting this one out. They said, hey, if you involve him, you want the only thing that I'm going to ask him.
She married him? Do you know who she is? Because Clara Hammer married him.
You know, but he's been here. You know my brother-in-law, Eliyahu Ben Chaim, Rabbi Eliyahu Ben Chaim. He's a Rosh Hashiva at YU.
I know who that is. Yeah.
He has a shul in Queens.
Right, I know who that is. Right.
That's her brother.
That's your brother. One second. He's Sfardi?
Yes.
He's
he also has...
Right.
He's my Google. He has a photographic memory. Whatever. Eli, where does it say this? It tells me.
So I say, so you're an intermarriage here.
Right, yeah, right.
Inter-ethnic marriage.
Yes.
But where do you live?
In Yerushalayim.
We just came back to Israel.
Here every inter-ethnic marriage brings more blessing. Less machloket. If you understand what I'm saying. So I'm saying, what do you do Pesach? What do you eat? You go Ashkenaz. So you lost in that area. And meat, but you...
My mother did that. We lived in Beit Israel. We were very mixed. I'm many generation Israeli. I'm not Sfardim.
Her family is... They're Sfardim. They're Latino.
I'm 7th generation Israeli.
My Malka's brother is married to a 7th generation Yerushalmi. Benditsa.
My mother spoke Yiddish fluently,
Yiddish,
the whole thing.
And Ladino, Arabic, and French.
And where did you go to school, Rothschild?
Yeah.
Landau.
You got it, Evelina.
Okay. Magnificent presentation. Magnificent.
If you want to hear something tomorrow, I'm pulling a big surprise in the Kollel. I'm lecturing on Rabbi Belkin. So few people know Rabbi Belkin. It's unbelievable. And even if you knew him, past 1945, it was very hard to know him intimately. So Larry Halperin is listening. You know Larry Halperin, Shimshon Halperin, that's Aaron Batt's brother-in-law. So he's listening to the shiur. So he calls me and he tells me what he... I said, you got to tell this story to the class. There's a classic story with Belkin. So he's going to be here tomorrow. And I'm going to...
I'll tell you, I work in YU, and I was a sick girl. You know, I was like 17, 18, and work-study, and I went to deliver stuff to Belkin. Belkin treated me like I was the most important person in the world. He was such a medj.
Right.
He was such a nice person.
Right.
I was like 18 years old. And
right.
You know, like... Just, you know, goodbye. And he really treated me, held the door, here's the elevator. He was so nice. I went to Revel, by the way, also. I finished Revel.
Yeah, you have a master's?
MS in 1970.
In what?
I did modern Jewish history with Rabbi Carmeli.
Uh-huh.
But I did have the Dr. Grinstein.
I did
have Dr.
Abrams. Abrams was my father's bosom friend. They were together when they were kids. So he calls me out of class. They had to get Belkin's speech for the dedication of Einstein to print it up. So he sends me to Belkin's house. I should bring back the most important document. You have to be very careful, he tells me, Abrams. It's a very, very important document. And I peeked.
Baruch Hashem, Baruch Hashem. So you have a share in history. Einstein.
That's why he's really, really good. Really good.
To meet you and find Tommy DeVue is from byutorah.org.
Where do you live?
I live here in...
Where were you from?
From London.
No, because I hear an accent that's not American.
Yeah.
What's your name?
Simon Montague.
Montague is a famous family if you're from that family.
I'm from that family.
Wow. All right, you should be Zaycha. How long are you living here?
Over 30 years. I came here in 82.
Baruch Hashem. That's Chati Chatzma. Mm-hmm. Beautiful. What do you do here?
I'm a software engineer.
Fabulous.
I work on Mozilla Firefox.
Fabulous. So you listen to YU Torah, okay, Bo?
Yeah, I listen to Rav Shua
every week. I have a problem, I have to blame you?
Not you could look at it that way.
I could look at it that every time a problem is solved, I have to thank you. How's that?
What did you want to ask me about silver?
The only thing I wanted to ask you about silver is that a friend called me just before Yom Tov. I think he's traveling tomorrow. He said, can I bring you anything? I would have done. I could still tell him. I don't know if it's possible to get them. I'll tell him to bring 10 copies or something. He's coming from Queens.
Yeah, in Queens you can get them anywhere. You want any bookstore. I know that Eichler has it. Or he calls the OU. They'll send it to him. UPS.
The question is if he can get it before he leaves tomorrow. I will call him and ask him.
You mean he's leaving New York tomorrow?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know.
Maybe. It depends when he's leaving.
I don't know. Lack of cooperation is...
I'm not cooperating. No. From within the OU, I have inside. I can get. From within the OU, I think I can get. I think I have. I will try to ask. How long will it be before this particular talk goes?
When are you going to put it up?
Elena by tomorrow.
Okay. By tomorrow. I think I can wait. I can remember from today till tomorrow, I hope.
Okay.
From this very table, from this very corner, some years ago, Chaim Soloveitchik spoke about that
Rupture and Reconstruction. Yeah, it's a fabulous article.
And it was the reason it was interesting was somebody said, why did you end on such a down note? And he started right away. He said the title of the article is, and then he gave the title of the original article.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And he said, you told me we can't, who was it, the tradition, told me that we can't do the whole thing. He says, okay, you can butcher it or you can let me cut it. So I cut off the end. The end wasn't such a down note. The end says a lot more interesting things. Do you have the original article? I have a copy. I'll send you.
I don't have the original. I have the published article. So
no,
can you say,
no, yeah? The original article was published in a, it's called.
Tradition is what I have.
No, right. Before that, he published it in a scholarly conference. In a big fat volume that I had to go to Bar Ilan to photograph it out of. But I have, I'll make you a photograph.
Fine.
You're going to use this all. Still use the title this way, this is what everybody knows. But I'm just telling you,
no.
You may be interested in the whole
thing. I didn't know that at all. What you told
me. That's part one. And it was here, because he started out and he said, the title of the article is, I've forgotten what it's called, Assimilation, and I've forgotten what it's called. And
Yechiel was in the Kollel many years ago.
Long ago. That's a far away, but long ago.
It was the 80s, the 80s.
Yeah. 79, 80,
I was. Wow, you in the Mamish.
Okay, so that, I have a few stories that you reminded me of that you may wish. You'll be welcome to them.
What do you mean, stories?
Oh, all kinds of things. Where, you know, every time you hit a point, I would think, oh, and also there's this, and also there's that. And you may know half of them. Some of them are things that you may or may not know.
Sure.
I'm sure you're not against new material, and I'm sure it's late, and the person who daven's early in the morning, you're not going
to
be able to do
it. Or you have to do, or no, if you have new material, adarabha, be adarabha. Adarabha, be adarabha.